because there were broken families or conflict at home or it was unsafe. And the end result was that young people sat in detention until there was an alternative safe place. And so a group of folks from First United Methodist Church, a local judge who was seeing that problem in his courtroom, said these young people don't need detention, they need attention. And so that's the name of Attention Homes. We were born. We have been for 51 years serving youth in our community. So that has typically looked like young people in group homes, in foster families that are supported and trained by Attention Homes, and then young people that are living on the streets. Does anybody have an idea of how many young people are experiencing homelessness in Boulder on any given night? And by young people, let's categorize that between the ages of 12 and 24.
150.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so low estimates are conducted by, there's counts that happen every year in January. It's called a point-in-time count. Imagine, if you would, heading around town with a clipboard trying to find people, especially teenagers that are experiencing homelessness. I promise you, you will not find them. And so those numbers are largely underrepresented, and we understand there are close to 1,200 youth in Boulder County on any given night experiencing homelessness. So as we dive through, I think one of the things that we need to do first is to define homelessness. This is the HUD definition of homelessness. So individuals and families who lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, or live in a shelter, or some other place not meant for human habitation, like a car, a abandoned building. Also those who will imminently lose their primary nighttime residence, so somebody who is facing eviction, and individuals or families who are fleeing or attempting to flee dangerous or life-threatening situations. Fortunately, in the U.S., we don't have a lot of folks that are fleeing life-threatening situations on the scale that you see in many countries where there's civil unrest. You do see people leaving domestic violence situations and ending up homelessness. It's a huge risk factor. When we talk about youth, however, often this definition of homelessness gets sort of tiered down to at risk of homelessness. So a great number of young people that are experiencing homelessness are living with multiple families under one roof. So is this working okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Couch surfing, so that's living on a friend's couch. How many people knew somebody in high school that, or have a child that knew somebody in high school that, or yourself experienced that you couldn't be at home and so stayed on a friend's parent's couch for a period of time or lived with family friends? It's pretty typical, and it's one of the protective factors for youth. However, for those of you that know, and those of you that don't know as well, it's not a permanent solution, and so a lot of young people spend a couple weeks, 3 weeks, a month, maybe, on somebody's couch, and then need to move on. And so we see a lot of young people that are bouncing from couch to couch, but still don't have a stable place to live. Staying in hotels and motels is pretty common for folks that are on the verge of homelessness or at risk of experiencing homelessness. And then, of course, any individual or family with a AMI stands for Area Median Income. In Boulder, it's $20,640 for an individual. So a little tidbit, at minimum wage, in order to afford rent in Boulder, this was just, I think it was the Community Foundation, so, but don't quote me exactly, I may be wrong about the source. Somebody earning minimum wage in Boulder in order to afford housing now would have to work 90 hours a week at minimum wage to afford to live in Boulder. That's under the guise that rent should be between 30 and 40% of one's income. So a lot of folks, even in our community, are on the edge of becoming homelessness. Why is that an issue? We'll get into risk factors shortly. We serve at Attention Homes ages 12 to 24. So when we talk about youth experiencing homelessness, that's the definition that we're using. Young people in early adolescence all the way through young adulthood. We'll talk a little bit about why. I'll give you a hint. Our brains are not fully developed until we are in our late 20s. We thought many, many years ago that at 18, miraculously, the cerebral cortex was fully developed, and you understood the consequences of your actions and could think through decisions. We've learned that that's not the case. Some people that know me will argue it's well into your 40s. We serve predominantly males. We'll talk about some of the reasons behind that as we talk about some of the risk factors. But I think that we know culturally that young women have more protective factors. People in general are more likely to say to a 16-year-old female, hey, we can help support you, than they will a 16-year-old male. Part of that is because 16-year-old males like to peacock. They can be a little bit rebellious, sometimes obstinate. And also, we just have a little bit more heart as a culture for teenage females than males. And so we serve twice as many males than we do females because they often have an alternative place to be. And then we serve about 5% transgender or non-binary youth, youth that don't define or identify with a specific gender. So this is the number, 213 individuals identified in the NDHI point in time count for Boulder County. Again, it's well known to be significantly undercounted. The asterisk on the right in the blueprint is really important. In January 2017, in the Denver metro area, so that includes the seven counties up and down the Front Range from South Denver all the way up through Broomfield and Boulder, over 900 youth were counted. So again, we think this is somewhere between 10 and 20% of the actual population. Based on the numbers of youth that we're seeing, there's a recent study out of Chapin Hall in Chicago that went around and did a Voices of Youth Count project. It was a big research project. At one point, a year ago, we were saying there were between 1.6 and 2.3 million youth on the streets of our country. Chapin Hall went out and spent 18 months studying and collecting data and doing research in multiple large cities, and that number looks to be more like 4 million. No. So even our earlier estimates are significantly understated. So the important thing with this 900, of course, that's 900 people at least that we know are experiencing homelessness in our age demographic. More specifically, there are only 60 shelter beds for that population. So now from 18 to 24, legally you're an adult, and so there are adult shelter beds in our communities. There are resources for adults. Again, when we talk about some of the risk factors for youth, the brain is not fully developed. An adult shelter, for example, can be a really scary place for a 23-year-old that's recently or newly experiencing homelessness. So last year we served 522 individual youth. 132 of them grew up in Boulder County. That means they played on a playground as a kid in our community. 8%, 40, report. And we asked this question within the first few days of working with youth. And so we know this is, again, understated. 8% of the youth that we worked with experienced sex trafficking here in our community or in the Denver metro area. This is not the Philippines. This is not the story of young people that are traded internationally. This is domestic, local sex trafficking. And 40%, nearly half, again, we asked this question pretty early in our relationship with young people, and so we know that it's understated. 40% reported having experienced labor trafficking. So that could be somebody held their documents. I think that judging by all the red in the room, this is a fairly educated crowd on trafficking. Often it looks like promise of pay that's not paid out. So somebody will be told, you can make $20 an hour in this job. They'll work for 80 hours, and then they'll hear from that business that the first 50 of those hours are training hours, and so they don't get paid their full rate for it. And then typically they lose their job, and the business recycles youth through that programming, and so they're getting very cheap labor. So that's the, unfortunately, that's the like light end of labor trafficking in our community. We do see youth that are in servitude, so their documents are being held while they do agricultural work. It's changing. There's a lot of education in the community. And then 100% of the youth that we work with have experienced trauma. We'll argue that walking into a homeless shelter at any age is a traumatic experience. There are a lot of mischaracterizations about youth experiencing homelessness especially, but a huge majority of the youth that we work with are pursuing a diploma or a GED or high school equivalency. You know, this notion that young people disrupted don't attend educational institutions is inaccurate. Half of the youth that we work with just about are employed, and a very small percentage use substances that are considered hard substances. Of the youth that use substances that we work with, the majority of those, about 78%, are smoking marijuana recreationally at least once a week. A small percentage of that report that it interferes with their ability to live independently. So that could be that They missed getting a job because of drug testing. It could be that they made an irresponsible choice because they were using. And why is this important? I want to be clear that we have this perception, I think, as a society that people experiencing homelessness that have mental health or substance use issues are this sort of far end of the spectrum in terms of substance use or mental health issues. Very typically, especially with youth, we see mental health issues that are anxiety or depressive disorders, right? Largely, it's situational. It's very typically episodic, meaning that, right, if you're having to find a place to sleep at night, it can create a lot of anxiety for you. And then we work, of course, with a lot of youth that are exiting the foster care system. One of the newest responses and trends is to start combating the reality that young people in the foster care system, especially in group homes or in residential centers, are easy targets for trafficking, right? They don't want to live in that environment. Some adult comes along and says, I've got an answer for you, I can help you out. Young person says, okay, that sounds great, I'd love to go get a cheeseburger with you. And next thing you know, they're being groomed for trafficking. And so a lot of youth centers now are doing a lot of work around the periphery of their organizations and their facilities to make sure that these predators aren't coming by. We have at Attention Homes, we have two facilities, and we have cameras that cover a fair amount of the perimeter of our building that we're checking very frequently to look for cars that may be hanging around in the corner or adults that are nearby. And then we do perimeter searches every hour. So we're actually walking the block around our properties to make sure that somebody's not hanging out. We have not had a recruiter come in for sex trafficking to our building, but we have had multiple labor trafficking recruiters come into our space. We catch them pretty quickly, and we report them, and largely nothing happens. It typically looks like a young adult that comes in and says, I need help, and we believe that. We're always going to believe that when somebody says they need help, that they need help. They come into our space, we work with them and get them enrolled and engaged in our programs, and then we hear that they're asking other youth if they want to go sell soap door-to-door or magazines door-to-door. And that's a pretty typical recruitment for this mobile sales crew trafficking. I don't know. Do people know what that is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of. I'll give you the briefest. So has anybody ever come to your door and said, I'm selling magazines for college?
Yes.
And if I sell 100 subscriptions, I get to go to this really cool internship for whatever, or I get to keep going to college, or I get, right, there's some story. What that actually looks like is vulnerable young people are recruited to go sell magazines. Let's just use magazines for this example. It's all kinds of products. They're taken on a bus to a foreign community. So it would look like going from Denver to Chicago. They're put up in a motel room. They're trained. They're buddied up with some other youth, and they go door to door. Or they split up on a certain block. They go through residential neighborhoods, very typically suburban residential neighborhoods. Literally knock on doors, sell magazines, get folks to sign up. And at the end of the day, all of that is tallied, and the person who has the least amount has to pay for the hotel room for the night. So most youth, when I say most, it's somewhere near 85% that are part of these sales crews, at the end of a month, owe the company money for room and board, and travel expenses, and each month, this is not absolute, but it's a very typical phenomenon, each month, the lowest producing member of the crew is left behind. So we've worked with 50 or 60 youth that have been left behind in Boulder County because they didn't meet their quota on a traveling sales crew, and they were from places like Indianapolis, Cleveland, Maine, you name it. So that's, you know, again, we'll get into the risk factors. That's a big part of the risk factors. Most of the youth that we work with meet this definition of at risk of experiencing homelessness. So they're sleeping on couches. They have a less than permanent place to be. They come to us knowing that time is going to run out. It's very typically a high school student. We see a lot of youth that are kicked out of their home because they're gay. And their family says, nope, not here. Young person goes and stays with a friend's family. As you know, having a guest in your home can be disruptive. And so for for the right reasons, families say, hey, let's find a more sustainable place for you to live, which is often where we come in. But 44%, right before we met them, were staying in a place not meant for human habitation. So sleeping in cars, there are abandoned buildings throughout Boulder County that young people are sleeping in. And of course, that includes camping or sleeping outside, which you know that's illegal in this community, right? And then the real truth about who we work with, we're working with students, musicians, artists, the local workforce. If you go get a coffee, if you go to just about any business on Pearl Street, if you go to any hotel in Boulder, if you go to any restaurant to go out and eat dinner, there's a really high likelihood that your food is being prepared by, ordered by, and served by youth that we worked with at some point. So they make up our workforce. If homelessness wasn't the thing that started, right, it wasn't sort of the foundation of a young person's move or trajectory through the workforce, often our local workforce is ending up homeless. So where we work with, for example, CU students, they lose their funding, they can't go to school, they say, I'm going to work for a year, and can't afford to live anywhere in Boulder on the wages that they make. So of course, this is not, you know, what people typically think of as, I see a young person with a backpack, and so they're homeless, and I can say that they're homeless. It's a really hidden issue. It's a hidden issue for youth experiencing homelessness. It's a hidden issue for youth that are being trafficked. Fortunately, they're incredibly resilient young people. I'll talk a little bit about brain development. That's sort of the point of where we're at. I want to quickly just tell you some of the facts and risks associated with being homeless at a young age. 1 in 10, this is the new research, youth between 18 and 25 endure some form of homelessness in a one-year period. So that's 10% of the population of 18 to 24-year-olds. That's a huge number of youth. Like I said, it's about 4 million a year in our country. And 1 in 30 young people between the ages of 13 and 17 will experience homelessness in any given year. If you ask, and we do, the system does, the country does, HUD does, if you ask people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when they began experiencing homelessness for the first time, 14 was the average age. So this isn't specific to youth. This is the entire population of folks experiencing homelessness over a course of years, that 14 was the beginning of those experiences. And then 15% of young people ages 10 to 18 will run away. It brings us to a very significant bullet below that. Did anybody ever run away when they were younger? I'll be really honest, I made it about 3 blocks. Right? It's very normative when you're a teenager to want to reach toward independence, right? I know how to make my own decisions. You're supposed to be separating a little bit from family, at least intellectually. Emotionally, the set of stuff that's going on is unbelievable. And so a lot of people will run from home, maybe make it 5 hours, maybe make it 5 blocks. What's scary about that is 1/3 of young people on the street within 48 hours would be solicited for trafficking or some type of transactional sex. So I will tell you a real story of this. We had a youth in our residential program, 16-year-old male, was online talking to another 16-year-old male, and they were playing video games together. And I think probably you're going to go down this road, it was actually a 16-year-old male that he was talking with. So, you know, it wasn't the sneaky trick of recruiting a young person. This young guy lived in Littleton, and so our friend that was staying with us took the bus down to Littleton to meet up with this guy and got lost in Littleton. And was down there for about 10 minutes and didn't have his cell phone, couldn't find this friend he was trying to meet up with, panicked, and went to the bus station, trying to find a way back to Boulder. He was picked up by 2 30-year-old men, brought back to their apartment, and sexually assaulted for 7 hours. So we say, within 48 hours on the street, this young guy had about 15 minutes. The men who picked him up were caught. This was 3 months ago. And what they offered this young guy was a ride back to Boulder to his group home and pretended to call and say that they had him and were bringing him back. He had given them the phone number of our house. So that's not uncommon. So when we talk about 15% of young people between 10 and 18 running away, this young guy got scared and within 15 minutes was in a pretty horrible situation. It can happen very, very quickly. A national study recently, this is actually a little higher now. This is outdated. We just found out that it's 53% left home because of physical abuse and close to 20% because of sexual abuse. Again, this is self-report. So this is young people. We know it's largely underrepresented numbers. So again, we think and we see and we ask questions and we get to know youth that all of these numbers are a third to 50% higher than what's represented. Over half of young people experiencing homelessness, and this is a statistic about people younger than 18 years old, so actual minors, report that their parents told them to leave, or when they were leaving, their parents said they didn't care. Go ahead, go. Poverty and family conflict are the two significant contributing factors to youth homelessness, and still, in our country, people are fighting over how many mouths they have to feed in a household. So families are letting young people go because they can't afford to feed them, to clothe them, and they invite the young person to go strike out on their own and figure it out. Approximately 40% of youth experiencing homelessness identify as LGBTQ, and LGBTQ youth are 120% at higher risk for experiencing homelessness. If you have, by the way, why is that? If you have questions, please just raise your hand and we're happy to answer them. This doesn't have to be a formal deal. I'm not, I do actually like the sound of my own voice. Right, I know this information, and so any way that I can help you have the information that you need, please just interrupt me, throw your hand up, whatever. Some more risk factors. About 75% of youth experiencing homelessness will drop out of school. I don't know if you know this, but if you drop out of school, it's really hard to get back in, especially if you've been on the streets for a year. We work really closely with McKinney-Vento, and so all young people have access to education in their communities, and we do get youth enrolled. One of the things that we see pretty typically is a young person that maybe dropped out of high school when they were 16, so they were a sophomore, let's say. Now they're 19 years old, right? They've been working on survival. How do I eat? Where do I sleep? How do I stay safe? And are expected to go back to high school again at 19 with 16-year-old peers. We know that social threats and physical threats are the same in terms of how our brain interprets them. I promise you 19-year-olds don't want to go to high school and be a sophomore. It's embarrassing. It can be shameful. And so it's really hard to reconnect young people back to school for right reasons, right? That's not their fault. HIV rates for youth experiencing homelessness are 3 times higher than the national average. Again, that speaks to trafficking, survival sex, which is trafficking. We know legally that trafficking is forced, fraud, and coercion. However, a 15-year-old who's having sex with somebody so that they have a safe place to sleep does fit the definition of sex trafficking. Very often they don't have the skill set to negotiate safe sex, to negotiate condom use, right? They just want who's ever like been really, really hungry for days and not had a safe place to sleep, food and a couch is a pretty appealing transaction if you have a commodity that you can trade for that. 5,000 young people die every year on the street because of assault, illness, and suicide. So, again, an underrepresented number. Many youth that are experiencing homelessness, living in shelters, living in assisted, supported housing programs, their schools don't even know, right, that they're experiencing homelessness. The community doesn't know, like I said, that they're experiencing homelessness. So you may read of a local dishwasher that died on the street, or a local waiter that got assaulted. And right, we don't always make that jump to that person was experiencing homelessness. And so we think that might be about a third of the young people that are dying on our streets each year. because of illness, assault, and suicide. Which brings us to our last sort of staggering statistic. Homeless youth are 60% more likely to attempt to commit suicide. Suicide and opioid overdose are competing right now for taking the most youth lives. In Utah, suicide just won this year. More deaths by suicide for youth than opioid overdoses, and we know that opioid overdoses are an epidemic. So, you know, we've done some version of this presentation for years to help people understand a little bit about what youth are experiencing. One of the models of our programming is to work very closely with youth. How do we develop and design programming that works for you, right? So it's not an adult-driven or authoritative process for the young people that are engaging, because we don't know what their needs are. We have an idea, right? Whatever the protective factors are, how can we help make those connections? And so one of the things that we do is we take all these presentations and we filter them through the youth that we work with. So we have a youth council, a group of youth leaders that contribute. They said, you know, this is great. This is a lot of national numbers. This is big, broad numbers. How do we capture some of the experience of youth in our community? And so we went around and we talked with street youth. And I will define street youth as youth that are on the street and are not willing to come into shelter programming, are not interested in housing at a given time, because they don't want to jump through the hoops that exist to get through that programming. For example, youth using opioids on the street may often be told that they need to get sober or clean before they can access housing. They don't have the skills or resources to get sober or clean, and so they don't access housing, and so subsequently stay on the streets. So we asked youth on the streets, what's it like in Boulder? This is all City of Boulder youth. The police told me to leave town was a quote from a young person that grew up here, went to Casey Middle School in Boulder High. And they were experiencing homelessness by the library. Law enforcement came and said, you need to get out of town. It's the only town they know. Someone took my stuff. Where can I go to the bathroom? For young women, one of the hardest things is to get your period living on the street. Tampons are incredibly expensive. Most young women are not using sanitary napkins and don't have access to those kinds of resources. Socks is super important. I will say tampons are incredibly important as well. We hand them out on the street. A youth reported that 16 people told them to get a job. This was a youth who was working at Starbucks at the time. But they were outside looking, appearing like a homeless youth and dirty. And so people yell, get a job, right? I wore out my shoes again. We have a video on our website of a young person that went through 13 pairs of shoes in a year because there weren't services available to this young person. And so he would walk all day long and literally would wear out shoes each month. This is a really sad story. So a young person that we know very well, I said, you know, what are some of the things, if you wanted to give a quote to what the experience was. And so there's a story behind this one that I want you to hear. If you drive down Broadway, at the corner of Canyon, very often you'll see people spanging, holding a sign saying, I'm experiencing homelessness, or I need gas, or I've got a crisis situation, or I've got a baby on the way, whatever the story is, the backstory. Sometimes it says, why lie, I want beer, or whatever. Most typically, the people who have those signs, by the way, it's humor. It's not actually that they want beer. They have found that it works. So this young woman was on the corner of Broadway and Canyon. It's the northwest corner, so right there is First Bank, right? The light was green and a car went by, and she had just a sign that said, change, ? The car was going, by her estimate, about 35 miles per hour. And the person in the passenger seat threw a handful of quarters, dimes, nickels, and pennies out of the car, giving her bruises and cuts on her face and body, welts. She picked it up and she said it was about $4 worth of change, and actually felt, in the moment, though not in hindsight, thankful for the $4 in change. Folks that are from here are asked to go back to where they're from. Where am I going to sleep tonight? How will I sleep tonight? Where can I get help? People ignore me. I'm not treated like a human being. Nobody's made eye contact with me. So many people, so this is often emphasized, so many people are ready to take advantage of me. It's cold in Boulder, even in May. It's nice in Boulder in January, too. Young people have to share with folks that they did not choose their gender identity or sexual orientation very often. Young people, even amidst what's very difficult, and I didn't put a lot of them on here, will say, I've met a lot of really great people in Boulder. There have been a lot of very kind people in Boulder that have stopped to help me or brought me a sandwich, offered to take me in for a period of time. And then another report of feeling invisible. So what's the good news, right? It's just sort of disheartening. The good news is that young people are incredibly resilient. Our brains continue to grow and change. We respond very well to adversity. There's actually a study that's going to be published pretty soon about youth having adverse experiences with a support system actually turn out to be better equipped and resilient later in life. So that would be a young person that's had adverse experiences and has a nurturing family or adult that helps them. And so we actually know that adverse experiences can be good in some ways. They help prepare us for life. They help give us the mechanisms and wire our brains in such a way that we're ready for adversity. Because it's a guarantee there's going to be adversity in life. The brain's not fully developed until, again, some are arguing, right, late 20s. Even 5 years ago, we talked about the brain, especially the cerebral cortex, the thinking part of our brain, not being developed until 24 or so. Now, a lot of experts are saying it's 28. Young people are eager to make change. I don't know if you remember being 18 and 19, 17 years old, and thinking to yourself, I'm going to just take over the world. Right? I'm going to do great things. Even though I don't have access to that right in this second, I am going to do awesome stuff. And then, of course, every youth we meet with is filled with hope. What can we do about that?
I don't know whether it's the location of your microphone. It seems to be getting worse.
Is it on? It's working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Less buzz. Great.
Okay.
Thank you, Arthur.
Found a good spot.
And then, of course, the number one protective factor that we know for youth, and this is true for everybody, is community, a sense of belonging, a support system. And, right, at least in the case for youth that show up to us, they've got a lot of caring adults. You look around this room, whether you're doing it directly or indirectly or just being in this conversation, you are supporting the community of youth here that needs support. And that's the thing that makes the difference. More than any other intervention, more than any other resource, having caring people. Okay, I can just talk really loud.
Okay,
can everybody hear me?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So really quickly, how the brain works, right? I think that most people know this. Our brain consists of about 100 billion neurons. There are neural pathways, it's electrical impulses, that connect at over 100 trillion points that relay electrical impulses that are information, essentially. Signals that form memories move through an individual nerve cell at a very tiny electrical charge. So it's not visible. You can see it. You can see some of this information in brain scanning techniques that are available. When one nerve cell connects to the other, it jumps a gap, and it triggers neurotransmitters. Right. So this is a process that, and this is the analogy or metaphor that I use very frequently. When I was a kid, we had this patch of woods in the middle of where I lived, in the town that I grew up in. On the other side of this patch of woods were my friends. I lived on this side of the patch of the woods. Two of my buddies lived on that side of this patch of woods. I lived there from kindergarten until 11th grade. When I first went over to my buddy's house, I was bushwhacking through this patch of woods. Right, I had to jump over logs, I had to sort of push through bushes. By the time we were in high school, there were multiple paths that were about this wide that we could walk down at night to get to each other's places. It was a whole network of trails through this patch of woods that we knew. You got here and you saw the shadow of this big tree and you turned right and you followed this path and this is where you ended up. Of course, it's not the exact same, but that is how our brain works. We create these pathways, we use these pathways, and they get very well formed. And what happens is that they become automatic in many ways. Right? So similar to me saying that we could walk through this path through the patch of woods at night without any light, we just knew how to get there, your brain does that too. It can change, that's the great thing, but you do develop these pathways that are very well formed. That said, again, we have neuroplasticity, so the capacity for creating new pathways exists throughout life. There are times during developmental periods where that's a little bit more active than other times. We used to think of the brain similarly to Plato. It's very moldable and malleable at a young age. That over time, what happens if you leave Plato out? It hardens. That's not the case. It's always malleable. But there are times during adolescence and early childhood where brain development is at its greatest. And so what happens is a bunch of pathways are created and then your brain does pruning. We don't really need some of these ones. Let's focus our energy over here. Let's refine how it works. And then let's have another explosion of creating these neural pathways. This is really, I'll get to why this is very important. Though part of the brain elasticity is that we are actually designed to adapt to our circumstances. That's just the deal. We are set up that way. That's the way our brain is set up. And what's really important is that our learning and the way that these pathways develop are founded in relationships. So we talk about it takes a village. We talk about community. There's a lot of talk right now about tribes. This group, your congregation, right? This is your community. This is a big piece of your community. You are learning constantly from each other. You rely on each other to learn. That's part of how, again, how we are designed. Not dissimilar from a pack animal in the way that we do better when we work together. You can see the what we've accomplished working together as humans over a very long period of time. How we learn is predicated on the environment in which we learn. So an example of that is if you're worried about how you're going to eat tonight, you're not terribly concerned, maybe, about how somebody else is feeling at the time. It makes it very difficult for you to be tuned to what other people's needs are when you're worried about your own survival. And that in situations there are... I'm going to jump really quickly and see if I've... I don't have it, but I can pull it up. There's a brain scan image of a 15-year-old that grew up in a loving, supportive family. And there's a brain scan image of a young person that grew up in a neglectful household. We don't know if there was abuse, but that wasn't the criteria. There was neglect. So they had to feed themselves at a young age, take care of a sibling, and didn't get the attention that they needed. And what you can see in these two brain images is the young person who grew up in a supportive environment had a very active, holistic and integrated brain, meaning all parts of the brain were working together. So brainstem right up through cortex. That information went in and got sent to the right places. For the young person that had experienced neglect at a young age, their brain scan showed a lot of activity in this, the part of our brain responsible for our limbic system. So it's our brainstem, our amygdala, the parts of our brain that detect threats and create a response. So we all know fight or flight, the adrenal response. For the young person who had been neglected, they couldn't actually translate information from that part of their brain that was activated by emotional response up to the thinking part of their brain. There were not pathways developed because they were always trying to figure out how to survive. So So trauma and safety and other risk factors do affect how we learn. This is that process I talked about. The hypothalamus controls and releases hormones, first adrenaline, then cortisol. It's meant to be short in duration. It's a really healthy process. There are rattlesnakes around here. I don't know, like not around the church specifically. But where we live, there are rattlesnakes. It's their territory. And so my brain, if I'm walking down and I see a rattlesnake, charges me up. My pupils dilate. I can take in a lot more oxygen. My muscles are ready to fire, right? My heart rate increases. Start sweating a little bit. I'm ready to get away from that. It's a very healthy thing. If every time that I walk down a trail, I saw a rattlesnake, and so I'm going to equate this to a young person and the risk factors that they face in their lives. At some point, everything that I see that looks remotely like a rattlesnake is going to trigger that same response in my brain. And that's what trauma does to brain development. Everything is a rattlesnake. Every stick is a rattlesnake. Every hose is a rattlesnake. Not literally, obviously. I think you get the point. What happens is you have toxic and ongoing stress impacts. You see people that, in our country, we're going to take away the not eating healthy, because if you don't have money to shop at Whole Foods, you're eating processed foods and people gain weight. But people who are really food insecure, sometimes we hear these stories of, I see these homeless young people and they don't have great access to food and they're starving, but they're overweight, which says to me that they're eating really well. And so you hear this narrative that sort of says, these youth don't need our help, or it's not an issue. This toxic stress, this ongoing toxic stress that we can define as trauma, actually creates weight gain, chronic illnesses. We have seen cases where our filtration system, liver and kidneys, fail as a result of toxic stress. I'm sure many people are very familiar with the cardiovascular implications of toxic stress. These chemicals that are supposed to be short in duration in our bodies, when they're not short in duration, are poison. They're really bad for us. And of course, then, you know, brain development and learning. And so survival mode makes it difficult, if not impossible, to be open and receptive to other people. Everybody's a threat. The stress can make one more excitable with less stimuli. Are we out of time?
No.
We're good? We've got choir folks there.
Okay. I'll share this too.
Yes.
With you, and you can.
Thank you.
Distress can make one more excitable with less stimuli. So we typically see this as young people getting triggered very quickly by maybe the lights go off, right? So we'll talk about our shelter. It's bedtime, the lights go off, and people start getting upset. Why is that? Maybe because something bad happened to them when the lights went off when they were kids. And then a lot of the trauma and the things that happen as a response to the trauma happen below our thinking brain. So ongoing unavoidable trauma starts shutting down the brain, learning ceases, options are not as clear to people that have experienced a lot of trauma. They don't know what their choices are and respond with that fight or flight response very typically, which then makes it very difficult to maintain the relationships that are so important for protective factors. And then trauma and reliving it becomes the lens through which someone sees the world. This is another statement about everything that closely resembles a snake is in fact a rattlesnake to the brains of young people. People, talking specifically about adolescents and young adults, but people in general. We're very good at assessing threats, and so our traumas also create that. And then how we respond to stimuli. The best way that I can, who's had food poisoning in here? Does anybody want to like be the victim of this? Do you feel okay about anybody feel okay about their food poisoning that they can talk about it? What was the food poisoning from?
It was from Japanese bean paste.
Ooh. Japanese bean paste. Have you eaten it since?
No.
No. If I put it in front of you, how would that be?
Oh, I'd be very bad.
What might happen?
I start immediately getting a vomiting sensation.
Yeah, there's these submandibular glands that produce saliva that lubricate our throats for when we're ready to vomit. It's the first sign that you're going to throw up. I think that many people know it. You start feeling this like, oh, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is an automatic response based on a trauma, and is the most typical trigger. If you think about what you got food poisoning from, again, I'm beating over the head with these analogies, because it's so important to understand that it's not a choice, that young people's response or people's response to their trauma triggers is not about a decision that they're making. It's automatic. You have no control over it. If you put in front of me key lime pie, I will start that. Very fun process. And that was years and years and years ago. I don't have any control over that. I have tried to regulate that. I've tried to put key lime pie in front of me. I had a bite of my wife's at dinner one time. I didn't eat for 24 hours after. It didn't actually make me sick, but it just is so stuck with me. And so your traumatic experiences, the traumatic experiences that youth have, hold those same triggers. So if you think about that in terms of relationship, if your relationship with a trusting adult is poisoned, it makes it very difficult or nearly impossible to develop a trusting relationship with adult again. Why is this important? Well, again, the resiliency of youth is that they will allow us to go into trusting relationships with them. And it is, again, the number one protective factor. So we are designed to work as a part of a complex social network. We're impacted by the experiences and perceptions of those experiences we have. And just as trauma and damage happens in relationship, healing, that's my daughter and I think just because, to sort of point out, right, how important it is that we have those relationships. As trauma and damage occur within relationships, the healing occurs as well. You will hear a lot about programming for youth and young adults, and people will say, this is our intervention, this is the service we provide, this is the thing that we do. We give them this type of therapy, we give them this type of resource. What we've learned, and it's really funny because the field has come sort of full circle again, what we've learned is that more important than any of those things is to sit and help young people rebuild trust and relationship. That playing a game of Uno with a young person has a more significant impact on their trauma recovery than 4 counseling sessions. So,
say it again.
Sitting and playing a game.
Oh.
I used Uno as a...
Oh.
Just spending quality time, not talking about trauma, not talking about emotional issues, not talking about anything. Just being with and interacting with a young person on a social basis has more impact than 4 counseling sessions on their trauma recovery. So we do provide those services at Attention Homes. We do all kinds of counseling. We have all kinds of modalities of intervention available. But the number one thing that we do is we take young people that we work with to go have a coffee. We listen to what they have to say. We don't judge them. I'll dive a little bit into where that is. That it is actually our primary intervention is relationship. And I say that not with like, oh, we're going off the rails here in Boulder at Attention Homes. It's a national thing. We are helping once again at Attention Homes and driving the national dialogue around what interventions work best with youth, that caring relationships buffer the stressful events and what happens with the brain chemistry and the release of those hormones actually shifts when somebody feels safe and comfortable, and that those caring relationships do lead to the resolution of those trauma responses within young people. And so when we talk about what that modality is and sort of label what that is, we call it being trauma-informed, or we call it trauma-informed care. It's an approach that understands the experiences that young people have had are not their fault, that their responses to triggers is not their fault, that if we can be there with them consistently, they will get better. And most importantly, it's a whole shift. We have till 10, is that right?
Yes.
Great, perfect timing. It's a whole shift in how we interact with each other and how we interact with youth. It's not just about the work that we do. I challenge each of you to go forward and start thinking about shifting the way that you interact with others. If you already do this, then great. It's an awesome start. It's about forgiveness. It's about resiliency. And it's about trusting that other people are doing the best they can with the resources, information, and capacity that they have available to them at a given time. And so you might see somebody, such a classic example because I have experienced it myself. I've got two little kids, 2 and 6 right now. And my wife and I are walking down Pearl Street, go to play in the fountain in the summertime, get something to eat. And along comes somebody who's clearly got some mental health issues, yelling and screaming, immediately creating in me a concern for the safety of my youth, right? Driving everybody on Pearl Street away from the center of the street, right? Sort of looking for safety because, oh, I'm angry, right? And you hear people say, like, what's wrong with that guy? My daughter even asked me, what's wrong with that guy? That is a fundamental barrier to people getting better and us changing the communities that we live in, is that simple question of what's wrong with that person. Being trauma-informed and honoring people's resiliency is about asking the question, what's happened to you? What happened that has you that upset? What happened that when the lights go off, you throw stuff? What happened that you're not ready to go back to school? What happened that you don't want to tell on your pimp? What happened that you're living in a box? If we can support other people's resiliency by asking them what happened and helping them navigate that, we can change the outcomes for the youth that we work with. And that's game over.
So we do have time here. Does anybody have any questions? I've got the microphone. I'm going to bring it back, and I'm going to start turning on some lights so we can see each other.
It's not on.
Oh, all right. It's not being used. Okay. It is now.
It's on now.
Did you have a question?
I do have a question.
All right. Is this on?
Yes.
I think in some sense your wisdom is quite ancient, right? The need for caring relationships and community. But what is the, there's something about our society that wants to fix things almost externally. What is the response to your kind of presentation by the medical community and the fixers in our organization and our world here? How do we fix something that people want to use with a pill instead of with a caring relationship? What do we do there?
Yeah, that's pretty loaded. I'm representing an organization, so I want to be careful. The medical industry and the psychiatric industry, very specifically, and psychologists are understanding this, and so it's not outside of the box. We just have the ability as a small community service provider and a series of small community service providers around the country. We have the luxury of being able to be moved very agile, right? So we learn this and we can shift immediately. And we've taken on this wholesale approach to learning and shifting and learning and shifting in our work. I'm talking about folks that are human service providers, so shelter systems, group homes, after school programs, et cetera, within that. We have the same information that the psychologists and psychiatrists have, and we're just able to do something more quickly. It is changing. In psychiatry now, they're looking at these models where it's not just a pill, that there are support groups, that there are how do we build those permanent connections and community connections. That said, a lot of people love to subscribe to this is the intervention that works. We want things to be replicable. We want things to be scalable. And that's really hard to swallow sometimes when you're looking for funding to say. And so we have to play that game a little bit. And so a great example of that is we do equine-assisted therapy for youth that have a lot of trauma. So that means working with a horse and therapist to work through what that trauma is and how to start working towards resolution. Not just that, but around that, we have a youth that's got a strong relationship with a trusting adult staff member. That's the transportation to and from. So it's not just the intervention. It's let's have you and your sponsor, this mentor of yours, drive you to the thing, talk for 45 minutes on the way, talk for 45 minutes on the way back, maybe stop and get a bite to eat. That it has to be holistic. And it is ancient. I mean, it's not, we have been saying for millennia that it takes a village, that we've understood the importance of community, that we've understood the importance of, we have as a society gotten farther and farther away from community. We isolate more, we take more pills. And so it is, yeah, you're absolutely right, it's a pushback. But it's a very natural one, so it's easy.
I didn't mean to disparage the medical community. I think pills are necessary,
absolutely.
And a lot of critical, but I think that it has to be a continuum where there's caring at one side and there's some kind of physical, external intervention on the other side.
Yeah, it has to be the whole spectrum. I also am not disparaging. We have youth that are only doing well because of psychotropic medication,
right?
Along with these other interventions and healing strategies.
Well, I just want, I'm aware of the building program. And so I want, unsolicited, I very much support your plan to put 40 apartments in for these kids on the parking lot at First Methodist Church.
Thank you.
Please say something about that.
Yeah, I'll give you your money after. So we just started construction. As many of you may know, about 3.5 years ago, we started working in the community in partnership with First United Methodist Church on their block, which is 15th and 14th in Spruce and Pine, right downtown in Boulder, to develop 40 units of non-time-limited supportive housing. So it is housing with no requirement, meaning that you don't have to be sober before you go in. We'll help you get sober while you're there. You don't have to have a job, but once you start living in the building, we'll help you get a job. We're going to put a social enterprise on site so that people have access to employment training and skills and have an income while they're living there. And then rent is 30% of one's income. So people are probably familiar with HUD's Section 8 program. It's very similar. If somebody has a job and they're making $300 a month, their rent will be $100 a month. If somebody loses their job, it's not the end of the world. They're not going to face losing housing because their rent will be 30% of zero. For the mathematicians out there, that's nothing. Some of the concerns that pop up, and I want to be very transparent about what we've experienced and what we've heard is that, well, if people don't have to pay rent or they don't have to have a job, won't they just sit in the apartment forever and not ever move on and just have free rent? And is that a misuse of government money? I've not yet met, and I've worked with something like 15,000 young people in 22 years of doing this work with youth, one young person ever that didn't want to and wasn't extremely motivated to strike out and do it on their own. I would bet there's not a person in this room, I would bet that you don't know anybody that at age 16 through age 25 wasn't desperate to do it on their own. The reason why people in that age group don't do it on their own is because they don't have access to the resources and skills that they need to do it on their own. And so it is only logical that if you provide the skills and resources to folks, they will do it on their own. They will move on. So what we see in projects like this across the nation is that there's an average tenancy of 24 months. So it's a one-year lease, so that means two leases and youth are moving on to stable, independent self-sufficiency. We've taken off the time limits because what if it takes 3 years? What if it takes 4 years? Beginning in April 2019, we will start leasing up young people between the ages of 18 and 24 that were previously living on the streets, give them keys to their very own unit, and support them in reaching their goals of moving towards independence. And the fence is up. We've got cranes there. It's about a 17 or 18 month development process.
How do you select? I mean, there's more people want than get, right?
Yep. There are a lot of selection processes. You have to meet the basic criteria of being homeless. You have to be between 18 and 24. You have to meet certain vulnerability thresholds. So that means we prioritize youth that have been on the streets longer. We prioritize youth that have experienced trafficking. We prioritize youth that have been assaulted on the streets. We prioritize youth that have vulnerable health conditions, mental health conditions. So a young person who Let's say you had two 19-year-olds, both had been on the street for a year, right? One had clinical depression, and one did not. It would be more appropriate in selection process to support the person with clinical depression, because we know the outcomes for somebody with a mental health issue or diagnosis are better if they're stable. That, yes, the answer is housing, but it's not housing by itself. And so we have to prioritize, but the need is humongous. We need a needs assessment, and it's like 1,700, and we have 40 units. So we prioritize people that need it most, but also, and this is tricky, youth that want that environment, right? So choice is very important for us in our successes, that we feel like we have choice. So there are a number of young people that don't want to live in a building where there are counselors all the time and case managers and, right, there are other young people living in that building. Some people don't want to live in a building where the only access is through a door that's controlled by a human being letting people in and out. It's not about security or rigidity or, you know, creating a prison-like environment. It is about helping to control the pathway a little bit. And so wanting to be in that environment, wanting to want the help, wanting to you know, be in a relationship with the people that are there helping is a criteria as well. And we'll see how that plays out. We've got 18 months to really dial it in, but the funders, right, there's a lot of $17.5 million project, and some of the funders, HUD especially, has requirements about how we select those that get in, and there's a whole assessment that's done, and people get scores. And so the higher you score, the higher you are on the list of prioritization is the basic gist of it.
Do we have any more questions, Ken?
Yeah. So how many, what would be the maximum occupants in those 40 units? Is it like 40 people?
Or? Yeah, so again, the subsidy is it's a voucher. And vouchers are only for a single person in this case. They're small units, and so it can only be one person. If a young woman, for example, is living there and has a child, then it would be two people. But there's no roommate situation. There's not, families aren't allowed to live together. Again, part of that is it's about the space and it's about the subsidy, but it's also about young people want to do it on their own. They want to have a dog, so you can't have dogs in the building. Here's an example, right? It's not intentional, but it is a positive collateral consequence, is that if you want to have a dog and have your boyfriend or girlfriend live with you and sleep over, there is incentive for you to get what you need to go get your own place, right? That that to live that normative sort of experience of having a boyfriend, girlfriend live with you, a dog, having a ferret, you know, whatever that is, being able to go out drinking at night, being able to have friends over for dinner, the things that a lot of people between the ages of 20 and 25 want, this unfortunately isn't the place to do that. And so how do we help get you ready for that transition to that part of your life? Yeah?
So I think I heard you saying maximum, they can stay 24 months. And then
no, there's no maximum.
Oh, no, actually, that's no what maximum. I was trying to clarify.
Yeah. Minimum of 1 year. They sign 1 year leases.
Yeah.
Nationally, the majority of youth, so it's 77%, mm-hmm. move on after the second year.
Yeah.
Close behind that is another group that needs an additional year. And then there's a small percentage that need more time than that. But most will move on within 2 years. But there's no, you could stay for 5 years.
Oh, okay. That's
6 years, 7 years. I'm right. I mean, it's intentionally not time limited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think you said something about that, but that answers my question. Thank
okay.
You.
Great.
Any more questions? Chris, you are living out the second great commandment of love your neighbors as yourself.
Oh,
Mountain View has an honorarium for you, this is part of the outreach team that we feel like this is one of the local missions that we want to support. So again, don't forget, sock it to human trafficking. We'll take socks next Sunday and everything. And I appreciate you all for being here this morning. And my, you all look good in red, I must say. I'm supposed to advertise for next week. We have the, and please forgive my pronunciation, Chris will understand this, the Leibnizian Cosmological Argument Did I do it right?
Leibnizian.
Leibnizian. Cosmological argument for the existence of God, or what is the bottom turtle? That's going to be next Sunday, and it's going to be moved to this room. It says in the church bulletin that it's going to be in Barker Hall. It's really in Fraser Parlor, and it'll be on this side of the closing curtain and everything. So that'll be at 9 and 10:30 next week, and maybe I can understand what David Jones is saying. I will certainly try. Mm-hmm. All right. And I want to thank Chris, and I want you all to thank you.
If you have questions also, our website's really easy. It's attentionhomes.org. And there's another website, boulderhomelessyouth.com, which is specific to the housing project and has a lot of FAQ about those specific kinds of questions, the subsidy, et cetera. And thank you for the offering.
Well, thank you. I'm just taking pictures to come and put in a message. To prove that you were here, so we can check that out. That's right.
And thank you all.